This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, organized lying. My guest is Sarah Jenkins from the Human Resources Management Department at Cardiff Business School. Our discussion was recorded on March 21st, 2019. Okay, I'm here with Sarah Jenkins from the University of Cardiff. Sarah is a reader at Cardiff University. She's a sociologist of organizations in the management, employment, and organization section there. First of all, Sarah, what's a reader? Can you explain to our American audience what that is?
Kind of like a lot of British terminology is quite anachronistic. And I think in the old days, it literally did mean that you spent your time reading, which would be great. Yeah, I think a lot of us would love that job. What they've actually done now in a kind of classic organization sort of politics is insert it before you get to professor. So it's another rung on the progression track that we have in the UK. So before you can become a professor, you have to go through the readership. And unfortunately, we have to do all the research and the teaching as well. And it's not just reading anymore. But that would be good.
But you just don't get the thing. Oh, so it's just like a higher vertical hierarchy, a couple extra steps.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a few more rungs to go to again. Yeah, absolutely.
In 2017, Sarah published a great paper with her co-author, Rick Delbridge, Trusted to Deceive, a case study of strategic deception and the normalization of lying at work. And it was in organization studies. First of all, thank you for joining us.
Let's get into
the paper first, and then I want to come back to life at business school just for a second. If we can. But before we start, let's talk about the study. And before we get into those details, let's talk about lying in general. Sometimes when we think of lying, we think of like betrayal or some type of underhanded moral transgression. But lying is very common, right? It's a commonplace facet of social life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Alan Goffman, you know, it's part of the wheels of sort of social interaction that we all engage in, no matter how much we don't like to admit it, but we do.
and it is definitely part of people's jobs, right? Like you point out, police officers or flight attendants. What type of work has been done on lying at work in the past?
Yeah, there's been some really great sociological studies. Shulman, who I think Shulman is based in the New York State University, the name is Cornell, and Shulman did a really great study about private detectives and how lying is a kind of feature of the work within a private detective's job. And then there's been kind of studies that have looked at lying in a more episodic manner. So a really good study by, again, some American academics called Alpert and Noble, who looked at the different features of lying in police work, some of which is just what they call administrative lying. So, for example, you're just about to finish duty, you get a call 2 minutes before you're about to sign off asking you to go to a situation, and you kind of ignore the request so that you can get home on time. So kind of the sort of things that we might do in order to save ourselves some time and protect us in organizations, to slightly more deceptive practices, like, you know, kind of pretending that you've got more information on the potential perpetrator than you actually have to get a confession. And then also some really interesting work that was done on flight attendants by Scott. And again, some of that is kind of has a moral dimension. So, for example, there's a problem with the flight. You don't want to make the passengers really nervous. So you say, oh, we're just having, we're just going to put some fuel in. You know, it's not, there's, you know, there's nothing to be alarmed about. So not actually saying we have a problem with the engine. And things such as, you know, again, a sort of a moral side of it where they're protecting people. So maybe there's a lot of kids on the flight that are wanting fizzy, soft, sugary drinks. The flight attendant thinks, actually, that's not really good for their health, and I'm only going to give them one. And then I'm going to pretend that we've run out. So different motivations that underscore the reasons why we might lie in organisations, to obviously then more kind of corrupt material advantage associated with deception. So there has been some really, really nice studies, but a lot of them do tend to be episodic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as part of our jobs, we all engage, as we mentioned earlier, in some features of deception. So I guess what we were interested in was this concept of strategic deception.
Right. But like group, and I read your paper as you're like looking at how like teams of liars
can
be developed. Like group lying or like, an association of lying can develop.
Absolutely. And this is partly because of this notion that Pat Wadden et al. 2009 came up with this conception of strategic deception, which is when organizations, their kind of main strategic business is underscored with deception. So in their case, they looked at Indian call centers that never say that they're actually based in India.
Right.
And so they're set up never to kind of to deceive, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And our organization was very similar in that sense. So it was set up never to divulge that the people working in it were actually located where they were. So kind of similar to the Pat Wadden study, but they were based in the UK. So in that context, the group is really important because everybody's got to engage in lying as part of their job.
So tell us, who did you observe? Tell us about your subjects.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because it came about because the chief executive, who was incredibly open and really kind of a pleasant person, they've won lots of awards. It's essentially a call center that engages in virtual reception services for companies that outsource essentially their reception and PA work. And she came to give a talk at Cardiff, and she was really kind of positive about the organisation and what a fantastic place it was to work and how happy the workers were. So of course, being kind of critical sociologists, we sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, right, I bet. Please let us come and speak to your employees, because, you know, the last thing we thought of was a call centre environment where people are really happy. So we went there, and much to our horror, I must admit, initially they were really, really happy. And we were stumped, you know, because you don't really want that much of a good story as a sociologist, because you're thinking, you know, the classic thing of you're not really being very critical. And so it was like, oh no, what are we going to do now? And I was like, well, look, hey, a sociologist, what we're trying to do is explain, you know, it's not false consciousness. There's a reason why these workers are really happy, and it's our job to try to kind of, you know, explain why they're happy.
Totally.
Lying was part of that story, but we didn't know that at the time. So that obviously one of the issues about why lying is incredibly pervasive in organisations but really doesn't get a lot of research space is because most of us don't knock on an organisation's door and say, please tell us about all the lies your employees tell. So it's really hard to get access to do this kind of research. So so this was great. So we literally went up, and they were very, very open, like I said, and said, yeah, come in and so speak to us. So there were three of us at the time in part of the study. There were about 100 employees, and we interviewed about 60 to 70 of them. So it was not far off three quarters of the workforce. We also observed them doing their job, so I sat beside them and shadowed them. And we also observed the recruitment and selection process. But it was mainly semi-structured interview data, which lasted about an hour. So they were quite in-depth, detailed. And what we were really kind of shocked at is how open and upfront they were about how they lie for a living, which, as I said, we hadn't anticipated. And it was kind of we had a long train journey home, and we were sort of like, oh my gosh, they lie, and they're really open about this. And this is not something we know much about from the literature. So we had to kind of quickly adapt the study.
All right. So wait, there's let's talk about how lying was rationalized. Like, what was the reasoning? How did these people live with being, you know, professional deceivers?
It's a really good point, because most of them admitted that even though now they were very, you know, over time they became more familiarized with lying. At the time, nearly all of them said they found it initially very, very difficult, because it goes against our social norms. So they said, you know, oh gosh, it was really, really hard. But what the study kind of identified was how lying for a living became normalized within the organization through processes of institutionalization, rationalization, and then socialization. So the company was very clever to start with, because I think one of the things it did was it linked the need to lie as part of the job with providing really high quality customer service. Mm-hmm. So what they became the market leaders in was the kind of high-end reception services. Mm-hmm. So each receptionist was given sort of about 30 clients that they became the PA for. Mm-hmm. And the emphasis was very much, you know, you will give them a very personalized, high-quality service. Mm-hmm. And you decide with them, in conjunction to their needs, what kind of service they want.
Right.
So there was a huge amount of kind of discretion on the employee to kind of negotiate the service delivery, which is very unusual for this kind of work.
Yeah. It's interesting. You think of it as a mixed job, usually, these call centers.
Huh. Yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and so this is definitely not a kind of tailorized, high quantity call center environment. It's a lot of the features of why it works in this organization is because it's small, it's familial, it's owned by a brother and sister. The fact that they didn't actually go to business school, I think, was a major factor in the kind of employment practices. they were really kind of cool, quite alternative people who sort of had worked in art and essentially said, look, they got together and said, there's a real need for this reception service, because actually one of them was a surfer and had a surf business. And he'd gone away, left his business with a kind of a traditional receptions kind of call center who'd actually lost him a lot of business. So he sort of got around and said to his sister, hey, there's a real kind of market need here for providing really good quality reception work. And they said, right, let's think of, if we're setting up a business ourselves, let's think of all the best things about what we found in previous organizations where we've worked, and let's see if we can do that here.
So it's interesting, because you think of a call center as a low human capital job, but they have sort of an HR strategy that seems to have a lot of empowerment.
Absolutely.
Now, did they hire from the most trained sort of tranche of this market? Like, were they getting sort of college graduates, or were they hiring from the same pool basically, and just succeeding with this empowerment strategy?
Yeah, really good point. The recruitment and selection was really key to this. And of course, with it being a kind of newish organization establishing itself only a few years before, it could actually do that. So it could say, this is what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And absolutely that. They were still sort of semi-skilled. They weren't kind of college educated employees. They were all women. They were, you know, working class women, mm-hmm. who demonstrated a high propensity for service quality. That's what they looked for. So people that had maybe had other kinds of jobs, but were really interested in providing a good customer service. Mm. And interestingly, one of the reasons, again, why they were so happy and why they were kind of content in the organization was some of them had worked for a really traditional, tailorized call center that mm-hmm. operated very close by, where it had the usual electronic monitoring. You know, they couldn't go to the loo when they needed to. They were pretty highly monitored. And so working in this environment was really different. And they did have a lot of discretion. But because of the degree of discretion, they needed to recruit people that they felt they could trust. And so they did use a lot of it was through familial relations and friendship ties, which kind of has its own control mechanism within it, doesn't it? You know, sort of if I'm recommending my friend for the job, then my friend's gonna, you know, obviously not go against what the organization wants, because it'll also reflect badly on me.
Right. Huh.
So it was quite homogenous, you know, white working class women who had previously worked in a range of mainly service roles, but had this propensity, as they saw it, for high quality service, that they would go the extra mile in service delivery.
It's really interesting, though, because it sort of runs against, I'd say like an orthodoxy or like maybe a proclivity in HR where we filter on education. And a lot of people who don't get high level, you know, degrees or things like that, they don't get tracked towards highly empowered, you know, jobs. It's a very, very interesting sort of HR model.
It is.
So wait, there was a socialization process, you said, that normalizes lying. What was it like? How did it work?
Well, I think the key thing with this is that the socialization wasn't just formalized. It wasn't just top down from the organization. So they were very good in kind of setting up the parameters of the values. And the irony with this organization was the kind of core values were trust and care. Hence the paper, you know, trusted to deceive, because it's kind of, you know, an oxymoron in many ways, that they kind of created this really strong culture value environment where people were really kind of, as I said, for cared for and trusted. The key thing I think about those values is, you know, lots of organizations say they have a strong value system, but it actually doesn't go much further than rhetoric. Whereas in this organization, they were really, really keen to ensure that that trust and care were actually promoted in everything they did, including the way the labour process was organised, hence the discretion and autonomy that they enjoyed was so much higher. So, but apart from those kind of broader social values that were kind of sort of discussed and talked a lot about and enforced through these practices, a lot of the socialisation was left to the group and the team. And so within the teams, where there were only four or five of them on a team, they would actually help one another deal with the kind of everyday lies and support one another, and also have a great deal of fun and creativity and joy from making up the kind of lies that they engaged in. So the sort of group processes of socialization, we would argue, were much more important than the formal processes.
Very interesting. You know, I thought about that notion that high quality professional customer service does involve some form of systematic deception. Like, do you think that it's like that form of deception is the deception that you saw is just an exaggerated version of, you know, part of everybody's job? Like, do you think we in the university industry do the same thing, or would you prefer not to go on the record with that one? Or
well, I think being, you know, being a reflexive researcher, you can't ignore the fact that, you know, when you do you research deception and lies, and you reflect on it in your own experiences, and more than a few times I've kind of mentioned to my colleagues, oh my gosh, you know, I research deception, and it's what we do every day. There's elements of it, and it's about those degrees, isn't it? And I think one of the reasons why it became normalized here was that initially it was seen to be kind of white lies, you know, it was small, it wasn't that significant, and it was things like, hey, if I actually worked in an office for my boss and I was his receptionist, you know, we would routinely say things like, oh, I'm afraid he's away from the office, when he didn't want to take calls.
Right.
So it's kind of normalized as part of what a job of a good receptionist would be in protecting the boss.
Yeah.
So some of it was definitely, you know, an accepted part of that role. And I think, you know, we look at a number of jobs and we can see, yeah, this is part of sort of what lots of work involves. But I think the other features of this is that the whole business, as I said, this strategic deception was predicated on the fact that because they offered such a kind of high quality service, they were never to tell the clients' customers that they were actually a virtual service. So they were always to pretend that they were physically located in the office where the customer had phoned. Had called, yeah. And so that was part of what the whole organization's USP was about. It was kind of, you never ever disclose that you are a call center.
Yeah. It reminded me some passages felt organization or organized crime like in yes. Sort of the meta messages that were being communicated. And I thought to myself, you know, I bet you if you had spent a couple months with a criminal organization, you'd find sometimes some similarities, no?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, and it did. And I think this is the key, because they were allowed to sort of negotiate the service delivery with the client directly, it was done in quite an informal way. And if I was going to work for you, Joe, and you and I had a really good rapport, then I would kind of, and you said to me, oh, Sarah, could you kind of make out like my organization is much, much bigger than it really is. So that when my clients and their customers, when they phone me, that you actually portray an image of me as being a really large organization. So I'm not actually just working out of my bedroom, right, that I've got this big organizational kind of behind me. And if I liked you and we got on and that was fine, I would do that.
Right.
But I wouldn't necessarily do it for everybody. Right. And, and not everybody would ask that and not everybody would want that. So it did stray into that sort of, ooh, this is getting to a stage of, this is deceptive and this is potentially fraudulent. Because lots of organizations that are slightly dubious may be attracted to these kind of virtual reception services for that very point. They might be a complete cover for a fraud organization. But by having, a kind of a sort of 24-hour reception service, it makes it seem as if this is a legitimate business.
Right. Well, let's switch gears for a second. Let's talk about field work. Mm-hmm. Doing ethnographic research in organizations. Did you do ethnography or was it strictly interviews? I'm sorry.
It was mainly interviews, but what I would call it was a kind of detailed qualitative case study.
Right.
So the observation was mainly shadowing or focused observation around like the recruitment, but mainly through the interviews.
And were there any sort of big methodological lessons that you took home from this experience that you might want to pass on to any of our other, listeners who are doing that type of work, organizational quality?
Yeah, I guess it's the point about, one of the joys and the pains of qualitative research is that, we have to be incredibly flexible. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you kind of end up going down an alley that you didn't think you were going to end up going down, and that requires us to be adaptive. And I think a lot of the time, especially, I teach research methods as well, and we often present an image of research methods which is quite sanitized and kind of quite processual, and mm-hmm. Everything is especially I think we see in the UK, with a lot of the PhD programs, you have to have your research questions and you have to know exactly what it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. But actually what this researcher said, with deception, he had no idea this was going to be a feature of the organization. Mm-hmm. Until we were there. And then we had to kind of slightly change track. And also, I guess, it's kind of going with your hunch and kind of going with your gut feeling of, yeah, there's something in this. And initially, I think, that's why we ended up interviewing so many people, was because we were skeptical about how happy they were. Yeah. And we did think, have these been selected for us? Are they really this kind of motivated? So we kind of did more and more and more just to kind of justify that. But it was very it was very interesting, and the organisation, I have to say, were fantastic in the sense that they were, you know, they really were true to form in that they, hey, we trust people, and you can speak to as many people as you want, and you can speak to them for how long you want to, without any problems whatsoever, because we trust them.
Right. You know, it's also like it's a testament to avoiding the pitfall of like imputing false consciousness on your yes. subjects. Like you could have just as easily walked in there, expected them all to be secretly miserable, and they tell you they're happy, and you say, oh, well, they don't know that they're unhappy. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, one is great because that's how you actually find things. I love that about what you did.
Great.
Also, it's like, research is boring when you're trying to prove a point that you yes. said in the beginning, right?
Yes. Well, that's what I say to students. It's kind of get really nervous when you say, well, you know, you might not actually end up doing the PhD or your study on this area, that it actually might be something quite different. And of course, that's terrifying, isn't it? Because you've got to, yeah. oh my God, I've done all this kind of literature evaluation. What am I going to do with it? But I said, well, what's the point of doing research if we know what it is we're going to find before we've done it? So it was really revelatory, yeah.
You know, it's hard though, because, you know, I also teach research methods and...
I feel your pain.
Well, it's like, and there's a real push, I think, to teach a sort of scientism.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, geez, how do you portray what we do then as social scientists? If it, mm-hmm. like, it's not hypothesis testing, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. But like, how do you portray the process or the, you know, the product that we're putting out, if not scientific tests?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would say is it's not scientific in that traditional kind of positivistic science tradition of what is science. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean to say that it's not relevant, robust, authentic and plausible. Mm. So what we're trying to do always is to ensure that we provide a kind of a really strong, robust story that represents our case and our study in an authentic way, in as true a way as we can kind of we do that. And there are, it's not quite the same approaches and methods that we have in the scientific method, but that doesn't mean to say that it shouldn't be systematic and rigorous, you know, in that way.
So what are you working on next?
Yeah, so I've moved into looking at worker cooperatives, which is quite it's interesting again, because in the UK we haven't had a very embedded kind of worker cooperative movement. But I think, you know, what's interesting is since the financial crisis, what we see with cooperative studies is that it kind of goes in waves, it's in cycles. Mm-hmm. So after a crisis, obviously we see a kind of a resurgence of interest in alternative forms. So I've done one study on a worker cooperative, and I'm now looking at, I've just done some research over the summer on a social care cooperative. So we have a major problem with social care employment in the UK, because it's very, I don't know if the similar situation in the US, it's very low paid. There's major problems of recruitment and turnover, and the quality of the care given can be very sort of sporadic. So I'm looking at an organisation which has kind of changed its whole approach from being a charity to a care cooperative, to see if that has an impact on the employee experience of work. So that's really interesting, and it's quite exciting in the context of Wales where we're based, because our government is very, very supportive of cooperatives and has passed a kind of legal requirement that organisations, when they outsource care, should look in the first instance to outsource to a cooperative. So it's kind of trying to create a framework where cooperatives are very much part of the kind of economic regeneration process in what is a very poor part of a Western economy. So it's interesting.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at @SociAnnex. And on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.